We'll get started. We actually have added another panelist. Dan Chu will be joining us a little bit late, but we'll get started with the group we've got now. And I'm very excited for our discussion. I'm Maren Lead. I'm a senior fellow here at CSIS and the director of a new project on entitled New Defense Approaches. And this event actually has its foundation in some work that we did for Joe Angelo, the director of readiness in the Office of Personnel and Readiness in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. The report, I think we have copies of the executive summary of the report. It was about surprise generally in some specific areas of potential surprise that DOD may be concerned with. And in conducting that work, which involved a sort of broad-based look at a range of disciplinary views on surprise and specific areas where strategic surprise might emerge, it became obvious to me that there are, and I think it's probably obvious to most of the people in the room, everybody in the room, I'm just a late bloomer, that there are all kinds of different ways of thinking about this problem, and they vary by time horizon, they vary by discipline, by organizational interest, et cetera. But there is also a general consensus that the possibility for surprise is increasing given the increasing interconnectedness of everything, it seems. And so it seems there is also a long-standing but still significant concern about how do we get our brains around the possibility of surprise if it is in fact becoming more likely. What approaches make the most sense? What may have worked in the past that's applicable for the future and not? And so we wanted to have a discussion this afternoon about different models for thinking about surprise, and we've assembled, I think, a great group of folks to do that with us. To my left is Alan Cohn. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Strategic Planning, Planning, at Department of Homeland Security. He's, the longest guy serving at DHS? 4 years, I think.
4 years.
Practically a lifetime. And is a lawyer by training, and we're very happy to have him here. Eric Lecklum is currently a strategic advisor to the QDDR, the Quadrennial, Diplomacy and Development Review, the other two Ds from the one that I typically deal with, at the State Department, and has a long background in the State Department, in the Defense Department. So he's going to talk to us about how they're thinking about risk and surprise from both the state and the AID perspectives. Gotham Mukunda is finishing up his PhD at MIT. He has a business background, consulting background, and also has done a significant amount of work in biosecurity. So he has both a technical and scientific and sort of outsider industry perspective on how people think about surprise. So I'd like to just ask each of them to make a few minutes of remarks, and then I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll open it up to a broader discussion. So take it away.
All right. I was hoping I wouldn't be the first one called on. But given that I am, I'll start off. Thank you, Maren, for the invitation. It's nice to be able to come and talk about these issues in this forum, and I think that we'll learn a lot from this. It always goes without saying DHS is a maturing organization. And so there are many entities within DHS that are looking at the question of strategic surprise. My office, the Office of Strategic Plans, which is in the DHS Office of Policy, has been working since we completed our Quadrennial Homeland Security Review at the beginning of this year on formalizing the process by which we do strategy development to include how we survey our environment current and emerging trends to identify potential areas of surprise and shock, and reduce that in our outlook. So, Homeland Security. One of the things we tried to do in the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review was to basically set our frame by which we look at these questions, because we were having, in essence, too much strategic surprise. Why was the Department of Homeland Security concerned about immigration reform? Why did the Department of Homeland Security seem to stumble when we had someone with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis try to cross the northern border? What was it that we were responsible for, and what were we not? So what we tried, the first thing that we wanted to do with our quadrennial review was establish the frame, a set of threats, a security environment, and a set of missions, and in that way bound, in a sense, the space for which we were responsible, inside of which our job is to minimize surprise and shock. And so just for the few of you in the room who haven't read the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review report in its entirety, I'll review quickly. The security environment is basically characterized by six threats, which, if you've read the National Security Strategy, will not be a surprise. Global terrorism of the type of that al-Qaeda and its allies and affiliates practice, high-consequence weapons of mass destruction, mass cyber intrusions and disruptions, pandemics and natural disasters, transnational crime, and smaller-scale terrorism. Those are arrayed against a set of five homeland security missions: preventing terrorism and enhancing security, securing and managing our borders, enforcing and administering our immigration laws, safeguarding and securing cyberspace, and ensuring resilience to disasters. And so it's fair to say that surprise can occur anywhere within that security environment and within any of those missions. So what we try to do is, and what we are trying to institutionalize, is to first think about surprise at the strategic level. So we want to look at current trends in that environment, emerging trends in that environment, look at the trajectory that we see, and in an effort to prepare ourselves strategically for what might occur, in a sense to set our strategy in that space, first as a whole, and then for each of our missions for that integrated security environment. That then establishes our strategic posture. Within that, there's obviously elements of surprise. Our intent is to minimize the degree to which that surprise is strategic. That is, that it demonstrates a failure in our strategic posture, rather than an operational contingency for which we need to be prepared. And so some of the ways that we do that: identification of established trends, and that's social, technological, environmental, economic, political. Marin points to a lot of those in the report. Identification of emerging trends, directional patterns of change in a particular issue area over a 2 to 15 year time frame. How do we weave those together then into narratives, what commonly referred to as futures analysis, problem framing, in particular trying to characterize levels of uncertainty within our within a given problem or associated with different aspects of the problem. And we are also looking to develop a robust capacity for risk analysis. Which is really identifying and estimating key unwanted outcomes in terms of their likelihood and their impact. And that's in order to let our decision makers make better decisions first about our strategic posture, and then second, about all those things that are foreseeable. Which of those will we focus our energies on, and how will we mitigate the risk posed by the security environment as a whole? And of course, trends, risk assessments, future worlds, intelligence, they don't eliminate residual uncertainty. And so in order to address that, we build agile and flexible capabilities. We spread uncertainty or risk, seeks ways to shape the strategic environment, and also look to balance security with strategies of resilience, because we cannot close every vulnerability. We need to increase the level of resilience, both individuals, families, communities, and structurally and by design, so that the solution to every challenge of the strategic environment doesn't need to be a security solution. I'll raise one point. I know we're not talking about the report, but I figure I'll raise it because it was spawned an interesting discussion. There's a statement in the report that says that that thinking about surprise ultimately can be reduced to an intelligence problem. And I disagree with that statement. I think that intelligence is an essential element in understanding aspects of our security environment, particularly those linked to threat. And the intelligence community has tremendous assets that are available to assist us in evaluating both threat, intent, likelihood. But there are tremendous amounts of other information and other disciplines, cultural, anthropomorphical, political, that we need to take into account, and other communities of interest, strategy, policy, academia, that help us form a total picture of current trends and emerging trends of problems and uncertainty. And thus, surprise is not ultimately reducible to an intelligence problem. It's a problem for all of us. So that's kind of the start. Thanks again for the invitation, and I look forward to the dialogue.
Great. Thanks, Alan. And I'll try to dovetail my remarks with what you just said. So when Maren asked me to come here, she gave me 17 questions and said, keep it to 3 or 5 minutes. So I will try to do that. But thank you again, Maren, for the invitation and to CSIS. I think from a state and USAID perspective, this is a great opportunity to mix it up, and we welcome the opportunity. So I'll get the paid advertisement out of the way. The only way I was able to escape the main state building today was if I promised to talk about the QDDR a little bit. But suffice to say, this is a strategic review that the Secretary of State has called for, and we will be publishing a final report in September or October of this year. But I think it will hit a lot of the things that we're going to talk about in the context of this panel with regards to how do you use management tools, how do you allocate resources, and how do you adjust your policy so that you're more responsive to potential strategic surprise. And I think that's what we're shooting for in the review on some level. So what I'd like to do today is talk about three basic things. One is give you a better sense of how state and USAID think not only about strategy and strategic issues, but also talk about how we think about surprise, because it's different for both of the agencies. Then give you some sense of what our capabilities are in that in regard to looking at surprise and also strategy, because they're linked. And then what I'll try to do, and we might have to save it for a Q&A because of the time, but give you a deep dive on some of the things that we're thinking about in the context of our review in terms of recommendations for improving our ability to manage surprise. And we'll go. I have some illustrative sort of scenarios that we can talk about. And then I'll dovetail probably off of what Dan is going to talk about with regards from a Department of Defense perspective. So very quickly, you all know that strategy as a term at state and USAID is something that differs depending on where you are in the organization, different timelines, different milestones. There's no agreed upon definition. In terms of surprise, I think state and USAID come at surprise from a similar perspective. But they, of course, vary depending on the type of work that they do around the world. So first, for state, in terms of thinking through what does surprise mean, it generally bends into two categories. One is, where are we going to be surprised in the sort of urgent inbox for the Secretary of State? And then there's an inbox of important things that she and her senior leaders need to continue to push every day on the agenda. And you can encounter surprise there as well. So in that first bin, things like North Korea, the Middle East peace process, these are urgent issues where surprise can happen almost every day, and the Secretary will be judged on her performance in that arena, wrongly or rightly, whether we're prepared for that surprise or not. In the important bucket, it's that balancing issue that the Secretary and the USAID Administrator have to do on a day-to-day basis, which is how do you focus on the urgent, deal with crises in the urgent and surprises while keeping the focus on the important. And I think Jim Baker is an excellent example of a Secretary of State who did that with cataclysmic world change going on, the end of the Cold War, the war in Kuwait with Iraq, and also not just managed to respond to those crises or those surprises, but also found the opportunity window in both of those. And I think that's an element that's maybe different on the state and USAID side, is as you think about strategic surprise, think about how we seize opportunities and not just respond to threats. I want to give you a couple of examples of surprise from the USAID perspective. And again, I think as you talk to development officers and civil service personnel around the world, they'll generally talk about the short term and the long term. And as you know, long-term development is where we really hope the U.S. Agency for International Development can contribute. But we're frequently asking as a national security system for USAID to contribute in the short run. And so I thought what I'd provide is a couple illustrative examples of where surprise can potentially come in both of those buckets. You're all familiar with the earthquake that hit Haiti earlier this year. And I think that's an example of surprise on a cataclysmic sort of act of God level. But that surprise has led to the reallocation of national treasure on the order of $622 million to date. Compare that against a government quake in Honduras last year, where we had a shift in government. We had programming from an aid perspective for long-term development at the order of $50 million on an annual basis. And suddenly that has to be readjusted based on realities on the ground in the short run. Another example going to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Again, a constant struggle between the urgent of the day and the importance of a long-term development strategy for rehabilitating Afghanistan post-conflict. I was talking with a USAID officer who was reflecting on that conundrum, and she said, you know, we're looking at today's reality almost 10 years out in Afghanistan, where we're wondering why we don't have a stronger political system in Afghanistan, when in the short run over the last 10 years we've been asked to give cash payments and targeted development to warlords. That discrepancy between the short run and our long-term development objectives has created essentially a strategic surprise for ourselves. It's a self-inflicted wound. And I think we're starting to understand that more comprehensively as we go through things like this review, not only on Afghanistan, but in terms of our overall QDDR. So in terms of looking forward in the QDDR, what we have going forward is a different time horizon. Right now, there's no common accepted time horizon for strategy or surprise in the context of the State Department or USAID. And what we're trying to do through this review, just like DHS, I think, did in their review and DOD through the QDR, was come upon some agreed upon terms, but also some frameworks and horizons. For the QDR, when I was working with Dan, it was 20 years out. For the State Department and USAID, it's a very aggressive 10 years. And so a few things that we're going to try to do. We're going to try to clarify our definition of what's strategic, both in terms of time scale, what does it mean in terms of scope and magnitude, or is it something more related to the complexity of the management of the national security arena, especially at the country level through our ambassadors. We need to improve our planning for surprise. It's really about that balanced anticipation of not just challenges and threats, but also opportunities. So in one way, we're doing what Chester Crocker and Ross Harrison have asked our national security establishment to do. And, you know, they've said it's imperative to do everything possible to build the possibility of surprise into the planning process. State and USAID both need to do that more comprehensively. And they went on to say it underscores the importance of developing a surprise absorption management capability. And I think through the QDDR, we're trying to do that on multiple levels. And I think, Maren, part of the beauty of this process and getting out and having these discussions, I think there's the possibility that in the context of the QDDR, we might actually need a definition of what is strategic surprise to state and USAID. There's a lot of good work in the review and also in the report and the drafts that I've seen with regards to what is that global context, but we might need to spend some more time internally thinking about that, so I will take that back. I'll save sort of what we're doing in the QDDR for Q&A, but I do really quickly want to talk about our baseline capabilities, and I'll keep it short because I see Maren already sniding me. So the baseline of today versus sort of today's analysis, and then there's the long term. Very quickly, the frontline analysis that happens for anticipating strategic surprises, of course, contingent on we have about 25,000 plus or minus Foreign Service nationals, career civil servants, and Foreign Service officers around the world at any given time. There are frontline and over 180 U.S. missions and embassies around the world. Feeding information, back to our point earlier on about information versus intelligence, back to headquarters, where you have country desk officers every day watching the world, looking out for near-term strategic surprise. They're supported by the intelligence community. We have a state operations center. We have organizations like SCRS that in the near term are doing contingency planning against some of those potential situations. We also have folks in the Office of Policy Planning, not only at state but now at USAID, looking at near-term strategic surprise, maybe from vectors that we're not anticipating. Unfortunately, I think the cumulative effect of all that information processing is that it doesn't really come to a head until you get up to the secretary or the USAID administrator, and I think that's something that we're going to try to fix in the QDDR. We, of course, have other sources of information. We work with all the partners across the table here, Department of Defense, DHS, the intelligence community I already mentioned, think tanks like CSIS, and there have been ongoing interagency collaborative efforts like Project Horizon, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with. But in all, I was talking with a senior state policy planner in preparation for this event. There's bottom line, there's no systematic system for thinking about strategic surprise at either state or USAID, and that's a problem. In the long run, our strategic planning processes are largely absent. Like Alan mentioned, in terms of DHS, our analytic capacity to process risk analysis, looking at long-term decision support analysis, it's pretty nascent. We have information coming in from think tanks, from the National Intelligence Council, but it's not well coupled, and the capacity, the actual staffing to produce the sort of products that you want decision makers to act upon is pretty thin. In terms of development, I think there is an understanding at USAID that we are caught right now in a conundrum, which is, around the world, we're asking USAID to produce short-term development outcomes, building schoolhouses and having teachers there to improve the lives and livelihood of children around the world, for example. How do you balance that against the perhaps more strategically important aspect of developing whole new educational systems for future generations? And we're constantly missing that bigger picture for the short run. So a few learning points for us in the QDDR going forward. I think from a strategic surprise perspective, 10 years in the long run may be too short. In our next QDDR, which will happen in 4 years from now, we'll probably look at expanding the timeline for our analytic horizon. And I think we also have to look very seriously at holding someone accountable, both at state and or at USAID, for improving the ability of state and USAID to respond to strategic surprise. So like I said at the outcome, we are trying to move to a more coherent system. I'd ask you to judge us on the outcomes. Those should be coming out in September and October. And I think the question is something along the lines of this. Have we reduced the for diplomacy and development and at state and USAID our vulnerability to strategic surprise? I have a couple more thoughts in terms of where we're looking at in specific trends, and I'll save that for Q&A.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I feel somewhat out of my depth on this panel, but as Maren said, I come from an academic and business background, so instead of talking about particulars of the governmental structure, where I think I can't be helpful, I thought I'd bring in a few general principles that come pop out of the academic literature and some things from the business literature as well. One is that inherent in the idea of surprise is the fact in competitive environments is that surprise is dynamic, that it is when you make a choice about what you will plan for, you almost definitionally create the possibilities for surprise because the number of things for which you can plan is finite. And your opponents and nature in the other world are aware, at least to some extent, of what you plan for and will then make their plans based on yours. And so what this means, in fact, is that we always look back and say, well, there were people talking about X before it happened. That was signal. That wasn't noise. Well, the two problems with that is that maybe the reason it was signal, not noise, is because you decided it was noise. And maybe you were right to decide that it was noise, because if you, because by focusing on other things that you thought were signal, you stopped worse things from happening, right? Which creates the interesting problem that this, I think, particularly shows up in the business world, that surprise is often as much a product of good decision-making as bad decision-making. That when you are making the right decisions, you are choosing to focus on some things and not on others, and in particular, you are ignoring information. Part of making decisions in the business world in particular, I find, is ignoring information quite a lot of the time. And by doing that, you create vulnerabilities. And yet, we cannot presumably make bad decisions preferentially, and therefore, we're caught in an infinite problem there. The third is that the key with dealing with sort of different types of surprise seems to be not organizational purpose, but organizational diversity. And the sense that, in particular, what I've seen is that adept sort of business organizations and large militaries will often be focused on a single goal. That's right. This is how you discipline. This is the best organization is one where everybody has the ball and they know exactly what the goal is and they know exactly what they're going to directed to do, and all efforts are focused toward this goal, right? And the problem with that sort with that thing is that that sort of organization is most efficient and most effective and is also most vulnerable to surprise, because it is precisely that focus that occludes information that allows you to be blindsided. And so the interesting problem here, of course, is that if you are in a competitive environment and you are not so focused on organization, you will be outcompeted by organizations that are. But if you are so focused on organization, then you are vulnerable to attack from organizations that have a radically different perspective. And so it seems as if one of the few things we can see that allow us to deal with that is the idea of having organizational diversity even at a cost to efficiency, right? Especially if you are a dominant player, as the American military usually is. This allows you the ability to do things and have organizations and modes of thinking that are not in consonant with the directed function. And so I will make the slightly heretical point here that our current, that the crusade for jointness in the American military that we've gone through over the last 30 years, although it has many virtues, can also have some pretty significant downsides, and they're hidden downsides, because precisely by being joint, we are homogenizing a community that used to be more diverse than it was. And clearly this has benefits, but just because the costs are invisible or have not yet been incurred doesn't mean that they are not real. And there is a considerable body of literature in the political science literature on military innovation that suggests that inter-service competition is in fact one of the big drivers of innovation in militaries. And one can ask the question, I'm just picking jointness as one example, of the places in which what seem like short-term good decisions and good thinking can have some significant long-term penalties of which we're not immediately aware. The fourth is that quite a few surprises from what the research I've seen are often the products not of failures but of success. And this is sort of one of the striking things here that there are some very interesting things about technological developments in the paper. Let me give an example from the real world that's happening right now. A company named Juul Biotechnologies was founded a year ago in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Juul's business model is very simple. They are using genetically modified organisms. They won't tell you what it is. It's not algae. Capture carbon dioxide captured from coal-fired power plants to create gasoline. They're building their pilot plant right now. It should be functional by the beginning of next year. And at least at the moment, there's every reason to believe that they'll be able to produce gasoline at a cost equivalency of about $50 per barrel. This would have vast strategic implications. I think everyone would agree with that. It would have significant implications for global warming. This is a nice thing, right? Most of us would be in favor of this sort of a technical thing. Yet this is a success that will have strategic implications that will be, you know, very difficult to think through. My friends founded the company, so I'm sort of familiar with them for a while, and I have no idea what this is going to do, right? How are the Saudis going to react to this? How will Middle Eastern politics be developed with this? I'm quite confident that the answer will be a lot. So the cost, what one might call the costs of success are costs that we like to pay, but they are not trivial, and they might be particularly hard to plan for. In the financial market, the people who most have to deal with sort of flexibility and surprises are traders, right? Traders in the financial markets. And the personality type that makes a very good trader is a little difficult to define. And it's often marked So most traders are probably just trading on noise, and it's very difficult to tell who's a good trader and who's just a lucky trader. But to the extent that the collected wisdom is right, it's often marked by what Keats, of all people, called negative capability, which is this idea to sort of have two directly opposed ideas in at the same time. And the particularly point here is that it combines a high degree of sensitivity to new information. That is, the most successful traders are the ones who do not fall in love with their own ideas and are willing to both say, okay, time to change, time to move, time to cut my losses and begin to exploit new opportunities. Yet, strikingly, they are also the people who are least likely to dither. That is, they either through luck, skill, instinct, or what have you, they are the people who are able to decide that this piece of new information is valuable and that one is not. And it's difficult to tell who these people are except through experience, right? Some of them just seem to last a very long time. Back when I was still in the financial sector, I was thinking about going to a venture capital firm, and the partner who founded it met with me, and he said, you know, if you're really, really good at the job, if you're one of the best people we've ever hired, your first year on the job, you'll lose us about $30 million. And I said, well, gee, I mean, I like to think I'd be good at the job, but he said, you know, that's just the way the business works. Your first year on the job, you're going to lose $30 million because you won't have any idea what you're doing, no matter how. And it seems to me that this sort of ability to survive in that environment is striking, but this ability also to be both flexible and rigid at the same time is extraordinarily difficult for government organizations in particular, which have to deal with criticism, both honest criticism and motivated bias from outsiders who will take advantage of mistakes that might, as I said earlier, be the product of good decisions. It's particularly particularly difficult for them. It's a very good point. And it's in fact, I would say that right. There are a lot of things we can learn from the financial system.
For those of you who didn't hear the point that was made, the question was, why did the financial system collapse?
And in fact, I would say that, and just a very, very briefly, right. And in fact, that actually plays very closely to this point, right? That what you see in a lot of organizations is that there are evolutionary pressures towards optimization. In the financial system, what that often defines as is increased leverage over time, right? That you see organizations that continually lever up. Levering is borrowing to increase the magnitude of your losses and of your gains and, unfortunately, also your losses. What leverage is a great deal like specialization. That is, as you become more leveraged, you are more specialized on your bets being right. But if you are less levered than your competitors, then as long as your competitors are right, you will lose. So this is the sort of tension. This is the same type of tension that we're talking about here, where the more you are right, the worse it is when you are wrong. But if you are not right, you don't get to play the game. And the last one is that the most sort of the two sets of surprises that seem to be most difficult to recover from are what I would call interaction events, right? One where a series of largely predictable trends that everybody knew of happened to encounter in a way that nobody anticipated. I just finished writing about this, so I will talk about it, is the First World War Royal Navy, which was surprised by the German use of U-boats to attack commerce before the war. And they were sufficiently surprised that they took 3 years to recover from this blow and almost lost the war. Now, the striking thing is that Sir Jackie Fisher wrote a memo in 1909 predicting that the Germans would use submarines in unrestricted commerce warfare. And Sir Jackie Fisher soon thereafter became first Sea Lord of the British Navy. So this is a remarkable thing to be surprised by something that your commander-in-chief predicted 5 years in advance. And yet they were surprised. And this was because, right, they saw a combination of events. They saw that submarine technology advanced and merchant shipping became both sort of concentrated in larger ships, and a large variety of things happened, all of which were entirely predictable. And yet the combination was not. So that's sort of six broader themes that I wanted to hit on, and I think my time has run out, but move on from here. Thank you.
Let me just briefly introduce Dan Chu. Very happy to have him join us. He's the Director of Strategic Planning in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and has both a master's and PhD from Johns Hopkins, I believe, and a BA from McGill, and a long history at IDA, CNA,
a bunch of other places
thinking about strategic planning. So why are we in this mess?
Let me start by talking to you a little bit about, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me, and my apologies for being late. I've been out of the country for the past couple of weeks, and I'm still kind of catching up with myself, both in terms of tasks that need to be done and, I think, jet lag in some way. So I apologize. It also means if there's something that I say that doesn't make sense, it's probably the jet lag. But you should feel free to ask me a question about it to see if I can explain it better anyway. What I'd like to start with first is a little bit about how I see DoD changing to deal with this issue of strategic surprise, and I'd be glad to answer some questions in terms of kind of how we got to where we are, to the need to change. And then I think there have been some great points raised already, and think we'll have a great discussion. But let me start by saying, and I think I'm echoing both Eric and Alan here, that strategic, well, actually all three speakers, that strategic surprise really is both a threats and opportunities, potential for unanticipated threats and opportunities. Being DOD, not surprisingly, we focus a lot on the threats side. We are trying to get better at the opportunity side, but I'll admit that most of our strategic planning to account for strategic surprise is primarily on the threats side. So really, there are two broad mechanisms, some of which are instantiated in very specific processes, some of which are a number of different interrelated processes in the Department of Defense that I would argue are our effort to manage the risks of strategic surprise. One is strategic planning, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we've changed the way we're doing that just over the past few months as a result of our recent quadrennial defense review. And the other is risk management, and I will talk to you about something that is very much a process in the making. In fact, had a meeting this morning with Joe Angelo on exactly this subject, and I'll talk to you a little bit about what we envision there and how we see this interrelating. Let me start with strategic planning. DOD, I'm very fortunate, DOD is really, really good at strategic planning. There are a lot of people, a lot of processes, a lot of products, a lot of effort put into strategic planning. To put it bluntly, we can plan the heck out of pretty much anything, and you just got to tell us what it is. The problem is, as you've heard already, when you plan and are remarkably precise about planning, which we can do, for a specific scenario, for a specific threat, for a specific trend, for a specific outlook, you run into the problem, the couple of problems that I would characterize as, first of all, over-optimization. You get really, really prepared for one specific thing, not so well prepared if something else happens. And a lot of rigidity. It's really hard to change direction. It's hard to change thinking. It's hard to change your capabilities. And it's hard to change your overall approach. That is, in fact, to answer your question, Mara, that's how we got to where we are. We are really good on one hand at strategic planning. On the other hand, we did it in a rather linear fashion and a rather narrowly focused fashion that I think got us into this condition where we have trained ourselves to over-optimize and be less flexible than we'd like to be. There are some benefits to it, as I think you quite well raised, Gautam. I think, obviously, as long as the conditions are appropriate for that, it keeps you out in front. But as the current conditions make clear, and frankly, I think we should have seen coming for some time, the broad international context is changing quite rapidly, and we need something that can deal more appropriately with it. So we've been paying a lot of attention to how you do strategic planning under conditions of uncertainty rather than certainty. And we start in a familiar place. I think when I came in, I heard Alan talking about this already. We look at trends. Because those are the sorts of things that you can start to use to look outward. The one thing we're doing differently, we've looked at trends before. We've looked at trends for a long time. The difference is before, when we were looking at trends, we were trying to forecast, which is a polite word for predict. We were trying to figure out what the future would be, again, so we could pick something to really plan the heck out of. And when we acknowledged that there was uncertainty, when we often found ourselves surprised, we said, darn it, the forecast just wasn't good enough. And if we could just find a way to make that forecast even better, even more precise, we would have an even better plan. And that, so the problem was precision. So we did things like come up with all sorts of elaborate ways to develop even more data to track trends, even more trends to track, even more tools, models, simulations, those sorts of things to try and forecast. again, we're pretty good at that, but I would argue that was the wrong thing to do. So what we're doing now is we're trying to change that approach, and rather than trying to take a forecasting or predictive approach to future security environments, and I think you'll see this reflected in our current QDR, we're trying to acknowledge, quite frankly, that there's a range of possibilities out there. And that we need to be prepared for a range of challenges and not for a particular forecast or outlook on the future. And that we need to have both processes, capabilities, and capacities, both, all three of those, in order to deal with changing conditions over time. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how we do that. But just to finish up on the trends piece, so the an example of how we're looking at trends differently now is, again, rather than trying to pick a handful of trends and extrapolate into a future security environment, we are picking a handful of trends, some that we think are key drivers of future security environment, but we're looking at variations amongst them. And based on those variations, now instead of planning for a given scenario in the future, we are actually planning for multiple scenarios. And we're looking at ranges of scenarios. In fact, we're looking at ranges of scenario sets, which are literally combinations of all sorts of scenarios representing the types of things the military might need to do in the future, everything from presence and deterrence type operations to assistance and building partnership capacity, all the way up to potential for warfight and other types of activities. We are looking at a range of these, and we are creating a planning process that allows us to plan for capabilities across that range. So again, instead of picking one point out in the future and saying this is what we're planning for and here's what we're going to have to meet that particular outlook, we are now planning for a range and looking for capabilities that are either robust or flexible enough to cover that range, or quite frankly, looking at opportunities to manage risk across that range. So I'll give you an example of that. In some cases, the capabilities that you need for a particular outlook are capabilities you can develop very quickly. If that's the case, quite frankly, from a risk management standpoint, our view is we can defer that decision until we absolutely need to. There's an indicator that we absolutely need to make that decision. On the other hand, there are some capabilities, ships, for example, are a good example of that, that take a long time and require a significant infrastructure to have. Those are ones that we might want to balance a little bit more, even if we don't have the immediate indicators, because it would be very difficult to develop those quickly over time. So that's one aspect of how we're changing strategic planning in the department to try and accommodate uncertainty, and by that kind of by definition, therefore, try and account better for the potential for strategic surprise. Of course, we could get the range wrong. So the range, even though it's better than a point prediction, could still miss where the strategic surprise comes from. My view is that's an unchangeable proposition. That's always going to be the case. So our response to that is to build a process that is more adaptable. And this relates to the point that was just made that, you know, you have to be able to recognize and digest and then change based on new material, new information more quickly. And that's what we're trying to do. So in the past, this very linear process I described to you before, which was very good at churning out very precise plans for very precise predictions, also took a really long time. So to do this, I mean, it was hundreds and thousands of man hours to accomplish these scenario outlooks and plans associated with them. And again, they were really only good for one particular outlook. And then moreover, after you've gone through all of that process, if you actually do see change on the horizon, convincing everyone to change all that work they just spent sometimes years developing could be very, very difficult. And I don't just mean, I'm not talking about people being stubborn. It literally is changing the way people are looking at things, and it can be very, very difficult. So we had a real problem with our process in the past. We are changing that now to, rather than this linear process of forecasting, scenarios, military approaches, military requirements, and then some sort of acquisition plan on the other end of it, we are changing that to what I would call more of a spiral development process. And what we are really talking about is taking a quick look at a range of potential future security environments, some scenario sets we use to essentially exemplify those security environments, and then a very quick look at military approaches and force structure. And then before we dive down into the nuts and bolts, and I mean that literally sometimes, how many nuts and bolts you mean, before we dive down to that level, we use that to then assess where we are relative to our force structure plan. And we look for key deltas, key differences between where we are headed with our current Future Years Defense Plan and where we think we might need to be based on this range of outlooks. And we can start to make adjustments there. Moreover, we can make adjustments to those outlooks and those potential requirements in the future much more quickly based on either guidance from our secretary, who may have a very different opinion, for example, on how to approach a particular military situation, or based on changes in our outlook for the security environment. We may see the range shifting around, or we may see something rising up in prominence that we really want to pay more attention to. And we can adjust this process more quickly than we have been able to in the past. So my opinion, we are trying to very much make the overall process much more adaptable and much more flexible. Finally, the other thing we're doing in the strategic planning process is we're paying particular attention to what I would call robust and flexible capabilities. We are looking in particular for the capabilities that cover the broadest range of scenarios or future security environments and trying to really emphasize those. And when I put robust and flexible together because I worry that sometimes when we say robust, people think of something that is just so sturdy, so strong, that no matter what the change is, it kind of remains unchanged. And can still, you know, withstand the situation. I don't mean that at all. I mean, in some cases, that may be the case. But I do mean flexibility in the terms of our ability to train our troops in ways that may need that may help them respond to different types of situations, to different types of different regions, different cultures, different engagements, and so forth. And trying to work that in again into our system to make the system overall more adaptable to this type of change. So those are, from my perspective, which as Marin told you, is mostly in the strategic planning realm for DoD, some of the key areas that we are trying to change the way we do strategic planning in order to account better for uncertainty and, by extension, be better prepared for the potential for strategic surprise. I'll mention one other, which, as I said, is a process in the works, but I think will be an important angle on this as well. Based on the QDR as well, the Secretary has asked the Department to develop an enterprise-wide risk management approach. And what this means is, and we have done risk assessments and risk management, again, in the department for a long time, but we tend to do it mostly in the military realm and then in some other very specific lanes. And we've never linked them up terribly well together. The Secretary has recognized this kind of stovepiping of risk assessments and really feels that it's important for us to have a truly departmental view on what risk is. And that means, by the way, that as we are planning for structure, which has been the emphasis of the strategic planning work that I've talked to you about thus far, we have to make sure we are paying attention to our institutional requirements, including things like healthcare, including things like various support programs to maintain the health of the volunteer force, including things like departmental infrastructure and business processes to support the kind of adaptability that I've been talking about. And so this risk management framework that we're working on is intended to try and address these issues. And I will argue, A, will incorporate some element, at least in part, of uncertainty and strategic surprise, but B, will also be trying to link that into literally the kind of the guts of the department and ensuring that we have the kind of flexibility and adaptability in the department so that we can be more responsive to that. So that's my DoD view. I just wanted to throw one other item in at the end here just to say what you're seeing at the table here, I don't think you should take lightly. So DHS, State, AID, and DoD sitting not only at the same table, but I think you've heard many, well, not that that's terribly unique, but I think you've heard many similar and overlapping ideas here. More importantly, we talk to each other a lot about this. And all I can say is in the many years that I've been doing this, I think this is a significant step forward. I think from a whole of government perspective, dealing with strategic surprise at the national level, this is a very, very important step step forward. And even as we all figure out methodologies, processes, personnel, and all of this, this may have more immediate value than all the intricacies that we work afterwards. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you all very much for very interesting and provocative comments. I wanted to follow up, actually, Dan, on your last point, to exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask a couple questions to start us off, which was about the whole of government approach to this set of issues. And while there is this coordination and a new office at the NSC stood up to try to better integrate strategic planning across the department or the executive branch writ large, one of the key parts of our report, and I think a sort of well-acknowledged point, is that many of our most significant national vulnerabilities exist in the seams between the departments. And so while there are largely, I think, growing but relatively informal relationships between the departments, how critical is it that there be a common view, that there be additional capacity, and what is there a sufficient process in place to table, given the bureaucratic challenges that frequently exist and constraints, to table issues where there are real interagency authority problems in particular, and then to address them? So how important is that in the context of the strategic surprise discussion? Anyone?
I'll give you at least a kind of a DOD perspective on an interagency question, but I think it's a good question. And the reason I said it that way is so I gave you certainly the DOD approach, but let me reel back one thing. There is a lot of interaction already on that front with DHS, with state, with AID. I'm not sure I'd call it informal. It's not necessarily structured, and you know, there's not a reporting chain per se, but it's quite regular and frequent and substantive. So I think there is a lot going on there. But I agree, particularly at a national level, if as a country we are going to try and avoid a strategic surprise. And DOD is very forthright about saying, quite frankly, even if we limit ourselves to national security issues, this very much is still a whole-of-government sort of approach that needs to be taken. The items that you mentioned are important. A common view is very important. I'd argue, at least my experience in this administration has been that that's gelling quite well. I think you can see it in the NSS. I think you can see it in the integration between the various Q reviews, that there has been a lot of work trying to collaborate on and integrate a common view. So I think we're making a lot of progress on that front. New capacities is a really good point. I suspect, again, I have the luxury of being in DOD. DOD has a ton of capacity on this front. I think a lot of the other agencies would like to have some of that capacity, and I think that makes sense. And I would argue there probably needs to be some overarching capacity. You mentioned the NSC strategic planning senior director, who right now I think has two people on her staff. Okay, three. So she's increased it by a significant factor, and yet, could she use more? Absolutely, she could. So I think that's a very good question, and I think that's to some extent the answer to the question of, and when there are SEAM issues, when there are authorities issues, particularly from an outlook and planning perspective, where should we be going? That certainly to me seems like at least the first step. So I think there are very good issues. I think we're making progress on some, and we definitely need to keep moving on others.
I would echo everything that Dan said, and in particular, I mean, from our department, and Dan in particular, we've kind of been learning at the knee from the experts, and greatly appreciate that. But I would echo Dan's point about the common view. Almost as, you know, as important as processes, and I think authorities, in a sense, what we've found as our relationship with DOD has matured in looking at some of these questions is that it's the viewpoint. If we can synthesize the viewpoint, we can harmonize the analytic capabilities that we have. We can then jointly approach the problem, and we can overcome the authorities' questions or the mission seam line questions relatively effectively. And in particular at the operational level, our operators are very good at figuring out the solution to how we combine our authorities and our capabilities. It's really at the, I think, at the strategic level as we look at that common viewpoint, what is it that we're trying to do? The question, Dan raised the point that DOD had often focused on the, you know, specific point in time in the future. And our department kind of started down that road in a sense of 15 national planning scenarios that were specific to a particular geography and place. And that was, and they became, they went from being representative to being canonical. Those were the 15 things that were going to happen. And we've really tried to reseat that along the lines of there are things that we are responsible for, flows of people and goods along legal pathways and illegal pathways, and that all of the scenarios and vignettes that we come up with are indeed that. They're vignettes that happen within those larger dialogues. I've been particularly happy to find a very receptive audience with DOD, first of all, there's a lot of effort to invite our department into DOD processes, not just at the "let me take information from you" level, but at a very senior level of "are we looking at this right?" And then when we have a discussion where perhaps we're all not looking at it the same way, and what's interesting is when it is DHS and certain elements of DOD and then other elements of DOD looking at it another way, there's also a receptiveness to say, okay, how would we look at it? How would we look at it in a way that makes sense to both departments? And so I think that's extremely positive. It's exactly the kind of thing that needs to happen. I think that that's a role that the NSC, in a sense, was almost created in part to do and is and has taken a long time to mature into, but hopefully with the creation of the strategic planning entity, kind of done in the last administration at a kind of smaller level, now trying to bring that to a more robust level that will reach that more institutionally.
Martin, the only thing I'd add from a state and USA perspective is reemphasizing what was said. There's a critical recognition in the context of state and aid's review that the whole of government approach to strategic planning is critical. The problem that we have at state and USAID is the capacity is not there to participate in those processes. And I'd actually pitch your question a little bit differently next time as you're thinking about it. Instead of looking at what are the seams or what are the problems at the seams, I think that undershoots the problem set. So
I thought you wanted me to ask about the opportunities.
Well, problems or opportunities at the seams. I think it's part of our lexicon as planners to focus there. But I think we need to really comprehensively think about there are problems in all of our cylinders, respectively, with regards to our mandates. It's not just at the seam points. It's actually the comprehensive orchestration of approaches against all of those cylinders of excellence. So it's not just the same points. In the context of the QDDR, what I'd say is we are, for the first time, state and USAID coming trying to bring two of those cylinders of excellence together from a strategic planning perspective. There was a discussion in the early parts of the review for what is the global context, what is this environment that we're facing, and I think that in and of itself as an outcome from the review will be very useful to facilitating conversations with DOD and DHS on these issues. But you'll see also, I think, attention as we go forward with our recommendations, that state, and to a particular sense USAID as well, really want to be in the lead in those processes and see themselves as uniquely positioned to work across all of those cylinders, vice just participating in my home organization's planning process, which is, while useful for state and USAID, is entirely insufficient for the scope of their mandate. We can't, as state and aid, just be reactive to DOD's planning processes, the contingencies of the world, and that gets back to the opportunities point of needing to spend analytic, serious professional cadre time on opportunities.
Well, let me, I more questions, but I'll open it up to the rest of you. I apologize for taking so long with our discussion. So let me get to you, unless we've all been impressed by everything so much. You have no questions, but go ahead.
Much. Both Judge Richard Posner and...
Sorry, can you identify... I apologize. Can you identify yourself quickly and...
John Fox. Thanks. I'm a strategic threat forecaster at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency's Advanced Systems and Concepts Office. Both Judge Richard Posner and Cass Sunstein, from different perspectives, talk about how it's almost impossible to get bureaucracies to address worst-case scenarios, catastrophic circumstances. How do you go about getting your respective organizations to address the really bad things? I ask this with particular interest to Mr. Chu, because I work within the WMD area, and it's really very difficult getting our respective organizations to really begin addressing potential catastrophic scenarios. Thank you.
Hi, Jonathan. It's nice to see you again. I hesitate to answer because on the one hand, you know, in DOD, I don't have problems getting people to focus on worst case analysis. Quite often, I have problems keeping people from over optimizing on just the worst case analysis. It depends a little bit on what you consider worst case as well. Somebody has already mentioned kind of the likelihood times consequence kind of calculus that we tend to use for risk. And if worst case is all about consequence, or is worst case all about likelihood, or again usually some combination of the two. But I have to say I don't think DOD has a problem focusing on worst case. I do think the DOD has a problem focusing on complicated case. And so I think what you're getting at, and I would agree with it, is in some cases we may, to some extent, oversimplify the nature of the threat to make it something that we're used to planning for. And that is a challenge that DOD has had. And in many cases, for example, planning for a WMD threat is very, very complicated. We don't have a lot of experience with it. And as a result, we often simplify it away in some respects. That, I think, is the real problem that we have in that area. And that, again, is something that we're trying to get at by creating these multiple sets of scenarios. And one of the things we are trying to do when we look at these sets is ensure that the sets represent what we call plausible, but also areas of concern with regard to the future security environment. So we have directly looked at the role of WMD in the future security environment, and we're working very hard to make sure that the sets that we plan for include a better representation of that. I'm not going to argue we're all the way there yet, but we're trying to tackle that particular problem head on. And I think it's really very important. Let me give you a notional example of one area that I think it demonstrates how complicated and difficult this is. You've heard the Undersecretary, I think, just a few days ago, and you've certainly heard many other senior officials talk about their grave concern with the possibility of a WMD attack on the U.S. homeland. So let's talk about that as a scenario. How do you plan for that? So DOD is very good at planning for it if you tell them what the WMD is, who's bringing it, where they're bringing it to, and when you expect it to happen. And if you lay that scenario out, we can come up with a really good mitigation plan for it. But if you lay out a much more ambiguous, uncertain threat with a great deal of ambiguity in terms of timeline, in terms of actor, in terms of you name it, it's very I mean, it would be difficult for any of us to plan for. But that's the nature of the threat. And so we're working very hard on trying to, we're using some gaming techniques, we're using a lot of different ways to try and look through ways to, again, develop contingency plans that deal with that type of complexity, and then trying to represent it better in our strategic planning process. I'm not saying it is easy, but I'm saying we're trying.
Hi, I'm Marcia Smith with the Space and Technology Policy Group. And you've been talking a lot about process, but it would help me at least if we took an example of a particular strategic surprise. And since you brought up Haiti, I'm assuming that strategic surprise does sweep in natural events, not just terrorists or other enemies coming after us. And one strategic surprise that Mother Nature might hand us is an intense solar flare that would take out our communication satellites GPS. It would affect all the government agencies and the business community and everybody else. So I'm curious if in your planning processes, do you look at this kind of an event, and how do each of you deal with it in the government and in the business community?
So yes, we do. In particular, I mean, that was one of the things that we wanted to accomplish with the quadrennial review and laying out the security environment as we did, was to make sure that we were communicating effectively, first and foremost to our leadership, and then to Congress and to the public, that this is the security environment with which we need to concern ourselves, and that you can't cheat by simply focusing on one piece of it, and then using the idea of strategic surprise to write off anything else as well. That was kind of tertiary or secondary consideration. We weren't thinking about that, et cetera. Funny, you had mentioned solar flares. We were at one of the leadership meetings debates on the quadrennial review. Craig Fugate, the administrator of FEMA, joined us by video teleconference from a conference on solar flares. So those things are on the radar. Now, of course, there is a consideration of likelihood that goes into the consideration and consequence about how you need to put things on the agenda. But I think I'd echo Dan's points that the balancing the disbelief that something like that could actually happen with the fascination that becomes the shiny ball that everyone focuses on. The challenge is really to look set that frame of these are the things we're responsible for, this is the threat environment, and then to go through comprehensively understanding what that means is in that environment, natural hazards as well as deliberate events. And also, there may be very deliberate events, but they aren't aimed at us. They just have secondary or tertiary effects on us. The destabilization of a particular region causing increased migration, causing flow of disease, et cetera. And so understanding that that the security environment is more complicated than simply the traditional threats that we think about. So.
Just from a state USAID perspective, you mentioned Haiti. To be quite brutally honest, the process for exploring those sorts of contingencies in the future at state and USAID together is pretty weak. But I think to your question on process, even though it is a procedural answer, the process of going through a quadrennial review like this, DOD has benefited from doing multiple QDRs. DHS, I think, is seeing the benefit of that sort of approach. Right now, it's a little too early for the judges within state and USA to say this was a value. But I think one thing that we've been able to see, at least in one of the task forces that I'm working on, is looking at how does state and USAID prepare itself for being a better actor globally in terms of preventing conflict, responding to instability, but also preparing for humanitarian crises that are inevitable. We actually have relatively good data in terms of going back historically, how many of these natural hazards happen. We have a pretty good sense of the capacity of our partners in the developing world with regards to their ability to handle a natural hazard and whether it becomes a natural disaster like it did in Haiti because of a lack of capacity. So given all of that information, it would seem to be relatively simple to say, here's a hypothetical future or a set of hypothetical futures. And so what we've been trying to do through our review is learn lessons from not only DHS, but principally from DOD in terms of how they go about force planning and bringing that into the civilian context, essentially for the first time. The State Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization had been doing that for the very narrow set of reconstruction and stabilization missions in the past. And what we've been able to do through this process of the review is open that analytic aperture up and say, let's go for a broader spectrum of potential hypothetical futures, all the way from natural disasters and maybe solar flares. I tried to get the meteor thing on there, and it didn't quite stick on the chart. But up to the sorts of hypothetical events that Dan laid out, and I'll take it one step further. We've talked about the hypothetical event of a WMD event in the homeland. there are plenty of situations, hypothetical, over the next 10 years that I think we can all collectively imagine in certain parts of Northeast Asia and in certain parts of Central Asia and South Central Asia with regards to a WMD event that would happen, and it would affect either one of our treaty allies or it would affect one of our critical partners in the war on terrorism. So if you think about that hypothetical future and the type of civilian, non-DOD civilian capacity that would be required, it's pretty shocking. And we would be turned to, as the United States, to step into that role. Right now, it's tough to say that we're really prepared for that. And I think Dan pointed out some of the complexity of what we need to be thinking about and how do you translate that into resources in an organization that has a very challenging time allocating resources over time and hedging bets at 10-year intervals.
You asked about the private sector. So the first answer to that question is that on the whole, the private sector doesn't. I think a lot of people in the private sector would say that that sort of catastrophic effect on society is outside of the scope of what any company could plan for or should plan for, right? That's what we pay these guys really generous salaries for. So there's that. But the one thing that you do notice, two things, right? One is that private sector companies have an ability to be flexible in a way that the government often does not. If you think back of the case of the Johnson & Johnson with the Tylenol poisoning case, right, where they had Tylenol was poisoning convenience stores, the way J&J dealt with that was the CEO of J&J dropped everything else on his plate, went down, you know, figured out what was going on there, and put out a national addressing. We are pulling everything off the stocks. This is my only priority. This is it. This is all we can do. The President of the United States doesn't really have that ability. There are always other things that he's got to worry about. And so that level of constraint upon government organizations, I think, makes it almost difficult to learn from how the private sector would deal with this. The set of problems is so different, and the set of capacities is so different, that I'm not sure how much I can tell you other than that outside of fairly broad bounds, every private sector organization which I'm aware says this is not our problem. The short phrase for that usually is that in the long run, remember, every single insurance company in the world is actuarially bankrupt. We don't like to think about that, but they all are. And I just, on the Meteor note, I want to know, I have the outline of a paper sitting on my desk right now arguing that the United States government's, you know, multi-administration decision not to deal with the statistical certainty of an orbital impactor is probably the single largest failure of government policy in the world.
Yeah, you heard it here first at CSIS Meteor. It's coming.
Let me just quickly add a couple of points. So first of all, in DOD, not surprisingly, we are focused on threats, adversaries, non-state and non-state actors. But we do plan for the types of natural events that might involve the military in terms of humanitarian operations, disaster relief, and so forth. So we do absolutely look at those and factor those in and do our best to account for them in much the way that Eric has laid out, in much the way DHS does domestically, by looking at things like historic incidents and trying to account for that in our future outlooks. So we definitely do look at those types of situations. In terms of the extreme catastrophic events, including things like solar flares or potentially catastrophic events like solar flares and meteors, there's at least one other person in this room that can attest to you that at DOD we do talk about these things. But as has been just mentioned, we tend not to plan for them explicitly. And let me talk a little bit about that, because this is it's not limited to solar flares and meteors. It includes a lot of other more tangible, not tangible is not the right word, but more traditional types of threats that create a challenge for us as we try and do planning, as we try and manage risks under condition of uncertainty. And that is, even if there's some statistical certainty, low probability, high consequence events, or long-term potential events, and so forth, and how you manage the risks for these. And I'll just paint the conundrum, because there's no simple answer for this. We simply cannot plan for every low probability, high consequence event. We'd go bankrupt, and I think we all recognize that. On the other hand, we should not. It would be unwise to simply plan for only the likely events, because if we did that, again, strategic surprise becomes our bane. So it is a matter very much, and this is probably the most used word in RQDR, a matter of balance, trying to find the balance in that risk based on available resources, based on your strategic approach, based on your outlook on the future. But that reminds me of one other point I just wanted to mention here so that it doesn't get lost. I think it's been implicit in a lot of the comments you've heard here. But trying to, you know, as I put it, manage the risks of strategic surprise or somehow deal with strategic surprise, let's remember, doesn't just need to be a reactive effort. It's not just how can I plan if and when the really bad thing happens to be ready for it. There is a proactive component to this as well. To the extent we see some of these trends emerging that could make some form of negative surprise more likely, how can we shape that future security environment? Again, I'm speaking from a DoD-centric standpoint, but how can we shape that future environment in order to minimize the negative impact? To the extent we see trends that might suggest a potential for a positive type of surprise, how can we maximize that? So this, we have to remember, this should not be just we should not just view this in a reactive kind of responsive manner, but think about it in proactive terms as well.
Hi, Mark Buckman from the National War College. Dan, if you could briefly, could you give us an update on where DoD is with the trends and shocks work that used to occur in your office? And then for the whole panel, I think maybe to one of Myron's points, does anybody have any good ideas about how to plan for, prepare for, or think about mitigating future surprises when the threat or the potential threat doesn't land squarely in anybody's lane? Things like cyber and WMD, where if you say, well, who owns WMD within the United States government? You know, who owns cyber? I mean, it's not clear, and certainly the laws and the policies haven't caught up with where the today's threats are, much less where the potential threats might be coming from.
So the quick update for everyone, just a little bit of background. My office has a portfolio called Trends and Shocks. It started in last administration looking at a broad range of long-term trends that we use to look at the future security environment. This is everything from economic, political, social, demographic, environmental, and other trends that we watch. And this is an example of one of the areas we've made some significant changes. So in the previous administration, the focus of this particular work was to study the trends well enough to, in order to be able to develop a model to predict shocks. And the theory, as I understood it, was that if you look back in history, most shocks were preceded by some noticeable change in trends, and therefore, if you could notice the change in the trend, one could more proactively predict shocks. I think you can tell by my tone of voice that I'm not a believer in that particular approach. The thing I liked about the Trends and Shocks work previously is that it got DoD thinking about non-military trends, demographics, economics, environmental issues, and recognizing that those could have an impact on security issues and that DoD needed to pay attention. That was a great advancement in one area. The thing I didn't like is that, again, it was put in a forecasting kind of model. And personally, I didn't think that was the right way to do it. I had a discussion with someone on this who said, we just need more data and bigger computers and we'll figure this out. I'm not a subscriber to that belief. So we took the Trends and Shocks portfolio and we modified it to do what I've been discussing here today, which is to really look at the trends, and rather than use them and try and delve so deeply into them that we come up with a single prediction, but to instead use them to identify key trends with some key variances in those trends that might lead to differences in our future security outlook. What key changes in demographics in a given region might change our outlook from there's going to be conflict in that region to there's not going to be conflict in that region? Not because we're predicting there will be or there won't be, but because we recognize that this variation is something we've got to watch for. So we do two things with that. A, as I said before, we plan for the range rather than for a point prediction. The other is we create these things we call signposts, which is if we really think the demographic change is going to be a key variable in making conflict more or less likely in a particular region, we make changes in that demographic indicator a signpost for us. If we start to see changes there, particularly in the negative direction, we use that to raise a red flag for us. That's something we need to pay more attention to and, frankly, something we need to plan better for. And we may start to skew the range of things we're planning for more in that direction as we see that signpost emerge. So that's really kind of a quick history of the trends and shocks portfolio in our office, but I think you can see there's a broader kind of a difference in approach that represents, and we're trying to manifest that much more broadly in the department's planning. On the cyber, WMD, other types of issues that clearly fall in between all of us, including private sector, here at the table, you're right. That's by far the hardest problem we face. Now, I can tell you DOD does a ton of planning, you know this, on cyber, but only in the DOD lane. I'm sure others do a ton of planning on cyber. I'm sure corporations do tons of planning on cyber, but probably just for their own corporate interests. We have to find a way to do a more holistic approach to this. And all I can say is DOD is working really hard already with our partners here to try and establish that. But I do believe that's something that's going to have a top-down driven solution at some point, and hopefully before we are in reactive mode.
I do think, building on Dan's point, I'll go back to an answer that I gave a little bit earlier, which is, again, that common viewpoint. What is the problem? How do we best view the problem? And who's responsible for what? Because as the creation of the Department of Homeland Security shows, I mean, you can combine an enormous number of people in an enormous number of organizations and not centralize control for a problem in an organization. So we in the federal government try both the let's create a department to do this model, and we also try the let's create a cross-departmental coordinator, be that the National Counterterrorism Center, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, FEMA, any number of NSC directorates to do cross-departmental coordination on problems. And we haven't really I don't think there's a consensus that one is either better than the other or that either of them work particularly well. Ultimately, what I think that we find is that we all just simply share responsibility for pieces of the problem, and that ultimately is the way that we end up having to approach it in the sense of the WMD problem, among other pieces that we have that we are trying to work, leaving aside the fact that you could that of the highest consequence WMD, some of it you can find in the United States. Generally, we think about certain pieces of it that at the end of the day, you're going to have to get it from outside the country to inside the country. Okay, so that part of the problem, there's a defined set of participants, and if we can look at that problem the same way, then we can try to get our arms around it. Another community of, well, if it goes off inside the United States or it occurs within the United States, what would we do? And we have different mechanisms for that. But again, I think in at least the experience that I've had in looking at it, it's that congregating the participants around a common viewpoint with an understanding of roles is going to be the key point. Whether that's done by the NSC, by a cross-departmental coordinator like the Office of National Drug Control Policy for counter-narcotics trafficking, or by departments simply kind of working the problem together in a bilateral or multilateral way, any of those can work if the viewpoints shared and the roles and responsibilities are understood.
The only other thing I'd say, Mark, real quickly, given your background and where you're sitting right now, you have an opportunity, as you know, to ask some hard questions about the implementation of the national security strategy. So the good news is these issues are recognized in that strategy as being comprehensive and cross-cutting. And I think, like Alan said, how is that implemented through what procedures, we'll see. But I think now the onus is on that part of the national security community called the national security staff. And hopefully they'll step forward. But in terms of preparing, I think state and USAID are trying to do a few things. One is a lot of these problems, the wicked problem set that you mentioned in terms of the coordination of how do you approach and how do you work through different roles and responsibilities depends on having the right people. So at State and USAID, I think through the review, you'll see a number of reforms in the HR arena. First off, with the types of people that we're recruiting in the future, there's a big push on focusing on innovators, entrepreneurs coming into the department. A huge emphasis, the message has been received within State and USAID with regards to improving education and training. So you're probably looking at a training education float akin to what DOD has in their individual account for personnel. And as Sandy knows, Art Zabrowski was fond of saying, for the realm of uncertainty, this surprise that we're talking about, it's really education that's going to get you the answer to fixing the uncertainty problem in the U.S. government. We can train for the known, and we can drill for that, but you really have to have people think through historical problem sets and the way to approach them and fix them, and then apply that conceptually in the future through education. So hopefully you'll see some more from State and Aid in that regard. We're also having a big push on the policy planning, joint planning perspective, building the capacity at State and USAID to participate in the sorts of processes that Alan mentioned. And I think the title of USAID's policy planning office, it's actually policy planning and learning. I think it also speaks to your point of needing to think more comprehensively about some of these new challenges and opportunities. Thanks.
Why don't we take there are three hands up. Okay, if everyone can ask a very short question, we'll answer them as efficiently as possible, and we'll call it a night. Can we have the mics up here? Are they? So one, two, three. Sorry, that wasn't one of the three. Sorry. Those two on the aisle, and then Sandy right here.
Hi, my name is David Fastun. I'm Director of Strategy and Technology Development for ITT. There's all kinds of surprise. There are surprises of intent. There's surprises of natural disaster. There's also technology surprise. Interestingly, I think we kind of have a technology surprise in what's going on in the Gulf, and that we have a technical failure that we really don't know how to deal with. So in your internal discussions at the higher ranges of government, are you getting any insights about the challenges of dealing with technology surprise?
Yeah, Jim Olson. I'm an independent consultant right now. My question was along the same lines as that, given that we have a perfect example of a strategic surprise and what's happening in the Gulf. What are the trends and indicators there that the panelists might think would stand out, and what are the opportunities that we should be thinking about in that process in solving that problem?
Sandy Swarzbach, Air Warfare Center at China Lake. My first question is to Eric. And you mentioned early on when you were looking at the two range of disasters, like the magnitude of the earthquake to the government shift, as ranges of things that you would cause to shift your strategy. Did it cause you to shift strategies in the State Department? Did you look at things that you did differently because of responses that were developed to those? Or did you develop differences in your strategic approaches based on the magnitude of those two approaches? And then in general, a question for the departments, did they incorporate some of the interesting things you've come up with in organizational development and organizational communication? Because you had some quite interesting insights, sir, on communication and strategic surprise and technological surprise. Did the departments call on business insights from developers and the outside? Did you guys call on outside consultants like the gentleman at the table to help you in your development of strategy?
Anybody want to dive in?
All right. I'll start with the easy one. Science and technology surprises, absolutely. It's one of the trends. I didn't mention it, but it's definitely one of the trend areas that we look for. And we look for them, and I think you presented it quite well, in both in terms of potential developments, I'll a little bit oversimplify here, but I think you'll get it, both in terms of potential positive developments and potential negative developments. And by positive, I don't mean good. I just mean, for example, an adversary gains a capability that we weren't anticipating, some sort of super radar, some sort of super stealth, something like that. Those are definitely tech trends that we are watching very closely. Potential negative ones are ones that happen to us. So potential for a failure of a major weapon system, potential for a failure of a type of technology that we've been relying on. For either integration or conduct of combat. Those are definitely things we try to track and look at as we go forward. Right now, in terms of the first type of tech surprise, we do tend to incorporate those into our scenarios and our strategic environment outlooks as part of the range that we need to be prepared for. The other part, though, I would argue, tends to come up more in what I've been talking about as our nascent, as in part of our risk management processes. The various risk management processes are not so nascent, but our attempt to knit them together in an enterprise-wide manner is more nascent. So we definitely do track those types of things quite extensively and look at what changes we need to be making or be prepared for should those types of developments arise. To address quickly the business insights piece, we definitely do. I hope you heard a lot of the themes that were mentioned before I started speaking directly in the changes I talked about us making in the department. And a lot of that has been based on learning from businesses, from a very wide range of businesses, some of whom do, and this would be something I'd love to discuss with you afterwards, look at, for example, catastrophic types of scenarios, like what happens if their industry goes away, and how do they plan for that, and what should their overall approach be. And as a result, we've learned a lot from those sorts of things. So we definitely do consult with and try to learn from businesses. But there are, again, as the discussion here has demonstrated, some differences, sometimes differences in scope, sometimes differences. You know, we DoD cannot measure its success and failure in terms of a single unit like profit and loss, which adds some complexity. But I absolutely think there's a ton to learn, and we are doing our best to incorporate as much as we can, including, for example, lessons from the financial meltdown. One of the things we did, we had a lot of risk management tools in the department that were fashioned very much on the same tools that, in my opinion anyway, at least contributed to the financial meltdown. And so some of the things we're trying to do is learn from that and ensure that we don't do that.
Thank you. So on the last question first, it certainly sounded to me like I heard a lot of echoes of the themes I brought up, but no one's called me, so. on technology surprise, that's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. Sort of one big learning, I think, from that is that technology surprises, when they're surprised, sort of dominant companies or sort of organizations, are usually from the things that you haven't been focusing on, and often not focusing on for good reasons. So they're the tasks that are the things that you always figured weren't really critical to your business and then suddenly became so because of the technology shift, right? So that means that the technology surprise is much less likely because something there was a bolt from the blue. And it's much more likely that it is surprising because of the particular dynamics of your organization, often dynamics that have served it extremely well in the past, right? The dynamics that have led it to success. So the just to make it very explicit, right? Clayton Christensen has a series of books that sort of talk about disruptive change and how, in fact, particular technologies are damaging to organizations because of the characteristic of the organization, not the characteristic of the technology. And that this is sort of a striking, like a different way from the way we normally think about it. And so I just note that a lot of these technology surprises can often be countered by organizations that are able to pass control quickly to that part of the organization that is most able to handle it. Clay talks about the Hewlett-Packard's ability to succeed with the technological revolution of inkjet printers when it was formerly dominant in laser printers. And the way it was able to do that was to create an independent inkjet unit, and when the independent inkjet unit became more profitable than the main unit, they said, you are now the company. They folded the rest of the company into this small unit. And I note that one way in which I think the American government's ability to deal with these sorts of rapid changes may have degraded, in most ways it's much better than it used to be, but may have degraded over the last few decades, is if you look at, say, the way the Navy handled Pearl Harbor, One of the first things we did was send our submarines out to be, tell our submarine captains to be much more aggressive in the early days of the Pacific War. And within a year after Pearl Harbor, something like two-thirds of American submarine captains had been relieved of command. Not because they weren't good officers. They were very good officers under the conditions before, that they had been trained for before the war. But under the radically new conditions of the doctrine of the war, they couldn't make that adjustment, right? Now, over how capable they were, they could not do that. You saw in the American Army that George Marshall sort of went through the upper ranks of the officer corps like the Grim Reaper, you know, getting rid of highly competent men who just weren't right for this position. And while I have no doubt that the median quality of the American officer corps has gone up a great deal now from what it was in 1940, there's no comparison between the two. I do note that the bureaucratic processes that took of the last 10 years seem to have been strikingly rigid with regards to personnel, that we don't seem to have seen very many general officers who were told, you know, you're a great guy, but you're not the great guy for, or the right guy for this situation. And to the extent that these bureaucratic sort of standards have helped performance, right, they have. We are much better off than with the old seniority style that we had in the 1930s. That's great, but to the extent that they trump this ability to be flexible at the last minute, and I think that has happened to a very great extent, this can, again, impose a hidden cost that doesn't hit you until the very last minute. So,
I'll try to group my answers for all three, starting with the technology piece, and if I can expand it to the realm of medicine as well. So three illustrative situations or surprises that we might think about in the context of a QDDR. What is the opportunity for state and USAID as they're conducting their activities abroad if we actually had technology that would allow us to do virtual language simulation real time? If you think about that sort of technological surprise for instruments of national statecraft like state and USAID, it's pretty revolutionary. If you think about now more from the threat spectrum, what's happening down in the Caribbean and Latin America with semi-submersibles and the advances of technology there with regards to illicit trafficking and facilitating the movement of massive amounts of supplies. In this case right now, it's drugs, narcotics. But you can think about human trafficking. You can think about weapons of mass destruction, threats that bleed into a broader spectrum that relates to the writ of state and USAID. And then if you think, again, from an opportunity standpoint of what would happen in terms of a technological solution for AIDS, if there was actually a cure for AIDS, what that would mean in terms of reprogramming for development assistance abroad, and how would we adjust to that? So I think those are some examples of the types of surprises that are out there on the horizon that are plausible, or we're trending that way already. And what we've tried to do at State and USAID, I think principally because of maybe the influence of the private sector and certain individuals that have come into political positions, I'd name USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah specifically in this regard. He's been a strong voice for improved science and technology, not only at AID, but across both the Department of State and USAID. And one of the things that he's pushing for very strongly in the context of this review is maybe it's time for a science and technology capacity or capability at USAID to think about what types of technologies we need to be pushing in, from a U.S. government standpoint to solve some of our really vexing development challenges abroad. We're also looking at things like you have to have the ability to think creatively, and that's why this emphasis on strategic planning and joining other agencies to think through some of these technological challenges, but also the opportunities and how they can permutate across our time horizons. To get to your question, Sandy, I would say, and it also links with the second gentleman's question, what we saw in Haiti, what we're seeing in the Gulf right now, also in the Kyrgyz Republic in terms of the breakdown in civil order, all unfortunate circumstances, terrible loss of life. But in terms of this discussion, I think one of the things that it has enabled, at least it's made the environment more ripe for these sorts of discussions, and I think that's a really good thing because it actually gives us a chance to talk anew about some solutions for actually fixing some of these problems that we have.
So I'll be very quick, and I'll go in the opposite direction. as we've kind of alternated, in terms of outside consultants and strategy, we were very, in a quadrennial review, we were very careful that we did not want to outsource our strategic thinking. And so we did not. In the subsequent, in our time after the completing the review, and in particular in developing a kind of strategy process for the department, we have talked extensively to entities across, not only our partner agencies and departments, but also private sector entities, both consultancies as well as corporations, to try to divine best practices from all. And it's a fascinating thing because our deputy secretary has an injunction that she tells us not to suffer from a Christopher Columbus problem, that just because something is new to you does not mean it is new. And so we struggle against that on the one hand, and on the other hand, that both government and corporations wrestle with these problems. There is not a solution that government just has been too slow to procure up till now. It is a universal problem that we all wrestle with. And so, but gathering the perspectives of many has been very helpful. In terms of the Haiti earthquake, the Gulf, did those shift strategies? I think that they will. I think, for example, you see that in the different way that perhaps USAID, DOD, and DHS will look at consequence management in the Western Hemisphere, and particularly the Caribbean Basin and North America. I think that there is going to be changes in strategies. In terms of the Gulf, you've seen that in the breakup of the Minerals Management Service, which is intended to come at the prevention problem, because it is simply so difficult to take a response posture to events like this. Trends and indicators from the Gulf, extreme uses of technology to do things that were not previously possible. That's a trend that we can see in a lot of other places. And the ability of private sector actors to have global impacts. The Gulf is just one of several that we've seen now in the last decade, the financial meltdown being another. These are you know, trends that we would be ill-advised to ignore, and that we should be looking across the environments that we look in to see where else they can reach up and bite us. Finally, with technology surprise, I do think our department is probably not as proactive as we would like to be in the area of technological surprise, and also in harnessing technology for opportunity. Point out one thing that people have been wrestling with is that, so the December 25th attempted terrorist attack on the Northwest flight was psychologically had a huge impact on the United States and caused us to do a whole lot to try to prevent people from getting on airplanes. But there was also a little bit of reporting about the fact that there was a United jet that took off from Hawaii and had an explosion on board of maybe about the same size as a bomb in somebody's underwear would cause. And it turned around and landed back in Hawaii. And that perhaps making sure airplanes can survive small blasts and that people can psychologically survive small blasts is maybe a better approach or just a different approach that technology can help us with. Of course, the flip side is the becoming enthralled with technological solutions that ultimately may fail us and create surprise in themselves.
Right. Well, thank you very much to all of our panelists. A really great discussion today, and thank you all for sticking around for a few extra minutes. We very much appreciate it, and we will maybe have you all back for a discussion of surprises coming from our positive strategic choices. Thanks very much, everyone.